So, I mean, you have to draw the line somewhere. At some point, physically, that's where the entry begins. And yeah, if he's completely outside of the threshold on the inside of the house, then any entry is an entry, you know, whether I just have to reach my arm inside or put my foot inside, I'm now in his house, and absent exigent circumstances or a warrant or consent, it's illegal.
Hey guys, if you missed out on the last conference in Nashville, Tennessee, you don't want to miss out on the next one. It's April 28th through May 3rd, Orlando, Florida, the Gaylord Palms Resort and Convention Center. You made a mistake missing the last one. You don't want that to happen again on this one. 5 days of some of the best training you're ever going to experience packed into one event. We have an early bird special right now, $50 off. Use 24 early bird on our website, streetcop.com. Look for the conference, click the link, register today. If you want to get significantly better at this profession in 5 days, don't dare miss out on the 2024 Street Cop Conference.
111.
I have some things I want to talk about too, but let's go into the first thing I want to talk about, your search incident to arrest or search incident citation.
Yes.
And we're talking about Knowles v. Iowa, United States v. Robinson. And then I think we go into your new theories.
Yeah. So I know we've talked about this before, and we may have done a podcast on it. Actually, I'm pretty sure we did, but you know, I evolve in my thinking sometimes. And this is one of those areas where I've definitely have taken on a new position. And you know, so search incident to citation, obviously Knowles is our case that kind of leads us there, but you know, when you combine Robinson, Knowles, and then Rawlings, all of them kind of interplay together. So I have two scenarios. So that's the true citation situation where we're issuing a citation to somebody. We've decided we're going to issue a citation. Knowles tells us that the justification for search incident to arrest that Robinson talks about, just it isn't there in a lot of the citation situations. But Knowles definitely does not say you could never do a search incident to a citation. But it said in that case, it wasn't reasonable to do it. Now, this was a case where the guy was getting a traffic citation. It was a speeding ticket.
Well, so he opted to give him a citation instead of arrest him for driving while suspended.
Yes. Whatever. It was a traffic offense, but he had clearly decided, actually, he had finished the citation. And then he did a search of the vehicle and I think he found some marijuana in there. And the Supreme
Court. And so we're clear, people, let me just jump in here real quick and say a few things. Mm-hmm. The reason he searched the vehicle incident to, or he would have done it incident to arrest, is because prior to a case that came out called Arizona v. Gantt, there was something called the Belton Brightline Rule.
Right.
New York v. Belton, 1979, I believe, was the year. I could be wrong on that, but I think it's 79.
80, I think it was 81.
Oh, 81. Okay. 81. Maybe it happened in 79. It got ruled
probably,
on.
Probably, yeah. It takes a couple of years to get there.
So what police officers would do prior to Gantt giving a more restriction on this is we would arrest for any offense, a warrant, a motor vehicle offense, and then you had the ability to, an authority, under the color of the law in the U.S. Constitution, to not only search the person, but also search the vehicle. And we're talking about a full-blown search of the vehicle.
Yeah.
Not under the automobile exception, under search incident to arrest. And that got restricted to the Gantt ruling. So to give some context, people are probably like, yeah, what the fuck is this guy talking about? This is a decision that happened during that time.
Yeah, I think it was 2000. It was before Gantt. Yeah, it was like 90.
05, 05.
Something like that. It was Gantt was 09. So yeah, it was before. It was pre-Gantt. Knowles was pre-Gantt. So anyway, he searched the vehicle and found a bunch of marijuana. And anyways, the Supreme Court said that was an illegal search because there was no one evidence that you could discover for a traffic ticket in that situation. And there was no threat to safety, no concern for weapons. And those are the two underlying reasons why we're allowed to do search incident to arrest. So the question, I think, well, let me go back a little bit. What we know from Knowles is that if you have decided to issue a citation, generally the underlying justifications for search incident to arrest are not present. However, I think that if you had a reason to believe the person was in possession of evidence of whatever you're citing them for, or the fruits of that crime, you could still be able, you could still do a search. And I think the case law is pretty clear post Knowles that that's still okay. So shoplifting, I think, is one that probably comes up more frequently than not, because in a lot of states we cite someone for shoplifting and release them. But if you had a reason to believe that this person who you're going to issue a citation to is currently in possession of the items that he stole, or more stolen property, Knowles would permit a search of that person for that evidence. Now, the search has to be limited in scope. Obviously, if you're searching for stolen property, depending on what he stole, you know, a frisk search may be all that you may be able to do. If he's in custody because he stole a bunch of DVDs, do they even sell DVDs anymore? I don't know. Maybe they do. But
yeah, they do.
So if they sell DVDs, you know, that a frisk search of his person would likely be reasonable if you had a reason to believe there was more, he had more DVDs on him, or we haven't recovered all the DVDs that he stole. But I don't think you could reach into his pockets because, you know, I don't think he'd have a DVD in his pocket, but you could do a frisk search. But the question that somebody asked me one time very recently is, well, what if it's a citable offense, but we choose not to cite the person, or we haven't decided whether we're going to cite them or not. We have the probable cause we need to write a citation, or we could also arrest them, but we haven't decided yet. Can we do a search incident to arrest? My response, and I think I'd said this before, it's like, yeah, I don't think you can do that. I think you have to either decide to arrest them, then do a search incident to arrest, or decide for a citation, and then you're limited by Knowles. But doing some research in the cases post Knowles, it's abundantly clear that because we have Rawlings, remember, Kentucky versus Rawlings tells us that the search incident to arrest can actually precede the formal arrest. The majority of the courts that have addressed this issue said, as long as the officer has probable cause to arrest the person and he hasn't decided to cite the person, then he could do a Rawlings search incident to arrest, a full-blown Robinson search of the person. And then either arrest the person. I think you should arrest the person. And I'll get to the policy concern after that. But as long as you haven't decided to cite, that's the key. As long as you haven't made the decision subjectively to cite the person, you could still do a full-blown search incident to arrest. And the cases in the lower courts are pretty consistent in the federal system and the state courts. Now the question.
Let me jump in. I just want to play devil's advocate here a little bit. No. I just want to jump in and play devil's advocate for a second. Do you think that should be something that's very consistent? You know what I'm saying, or inconsistent? So we start getting into different issues here.
Right. I think there should be a degree of consistency with this, and this is where the policy comes into play. So here's how I can see this turning out a lot of times. We've got probable cause to, let's make it shoplifting, make an arrest for shoplifting. So we don't declare that we're going to cite this person, but we're going to go ahead and do a full-blown Robinson Rawlings search of his person. We don't find anything. We still have PC for the shoplifting, but we don't find anything on his person, nothing, no drugs, no more contraband, nothing. So we go ahead and cite him anyway. We cite him and release him. So we did a search incident to arrest, but we never really had an arrest, you know, because a citation is not an arrest for Fourth Amendment purposes. Does that violate the Fourth Amendment? The fact that we did a full search, but we never ended up arresting the person in the end, does that violate the Fourth Amendment? It's pretty clear that it doesn't. That does not violate the Fourth Amendment. And actually, when I was doing my research, I went back and listened to the oral arguments in Knowles and in Atwater, which is the case that says you can make an arrest on a traffic citation, and then Virginia versus Moore. And this concern came up numerous times in those arguments where, well, what if the officer does the search and then he cites anyway? And the court said, well, we don't think that violates the Fourth Amendment. It may not be good policy. You know, if the public learns that that's how the police in their jurisdiction do business, it might cause the sheriff to get not reelected or the chief to get fired because it's a bad policy. But It probably doesn't violate the Fourth Amendment. And that's the position that I take. But as a policy matter, I think this is something that we should address, that if you're going, this is my recommendation. This is what I've recommended, started to recommend in my classes, is if you are going to do a pre-arrest search,
pre-handcuffing, right?
Pre-declaring this person under arrest search, then no matter what you find, you need to follow through with the arrest and process the arrest. So that's the policy. Is if you're going to do a Rawlings Robinson pre-arrest search incident to arrest, where you could cite, but you're going to go ahead and do a search, then I think regardless of what you find, a good policy would be you need to proceed with the arrest and go ahead and book that person instead of citing them. But you're done once you decide to cite them. If you go ahead and declare that you're going to cite the person, you lose that full Robinson search authority. So
I can certainly see an argument of like somebody coming to court and saying like, well, I know what's the policy of this police department. You guys, I mean, 94% of the time you guys are issuing citations. Right. So you tell me this officer on the last 93 times that he wrote the same citation for this borough ordinance or this city ordinance, whatever it is, or this shoplift, whatever it may be, whatever violation of law occurs. Now, all of a sudden he decides he's not going to do that and goes on a fishing expedition to my client's pockets.
Basically what it is a fishing expedition. Yeah.
And I'm going to say this real quick. Like, I don't think cops are savvy enough to explain themselves where I think a policy is a good idea here, to have bright line policy rules. But certainly, you know, I thought about that in the beginning. I wrote down, you know, you have to understand that even Zach and I, as we're discussing things here, are way above and beyond. And I'm not even saying I'm in the same category as Zach, but we're above and beyond 99%+ of law professionals considering the Fourth Amendment and how it's applicable. And so if you take what we're saying and try to explain this to them, you're going to have their fucking head spinning.
Yeah.
Even if we explain it to them, we'd probably have to slow it down, explain it very thoroughly to convince them and explain to them so they would probably submit that this is appropriate. But I like the idea that you also followed up with. I agree. I think it's so hard to understand when and how, outside of maybe a few categorical circumstances. And I also want to throw in there that you have to understand that that's not a bright line rule. You can't say every shoplifting is going to give you the ability to search somebody incident to arrest. You'd have to have reasons to believe that the proceeds of the shoplifting would be on the person's body. So I think, would you agree that we're actually even taking some of the Gantt ruling here and applying it to humans?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the points that I make, is that I think the Gantt reason to believe there's evidence of the crime of arrest on the person does come into play in a citation situation. I think regardless of whether you're going to do it or not, whether you're going to make the decision whether you're going to cite or arrest after the fact, I think the policy should come into play. If you're going to do a full search of the person, then to me, I think the policy should be, then there's no more citation. You can't get away with releasing them on a citation. Would that violate the Fourth Amendment if you did it? Probably not. It would not likely cause evidence to be suppressed if you searched them and then cited them. I don't think it's a good policy.
I want to say this, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, this might be a better way to go. You find yourself in a situation where somebody is quote unquote arrestable or citationable. You have an option there.
Yeah.
And before you make any decision, and you can't reveal this, just so you're clear, when we get consent to search somebody, we are not allowed to play psychological ploys, have consequences of refusal. It is basically a yes or no question. But what if you said to somebody, they're detained, they're lawful. Technically, they could be under arrest, but they're detained. They're not giving you a hard time. You say, at this point now, I'm going to ask for consent to search of your person. Right. Like, and at that point, if they decide to, without saying like, if you deny me consent, just know you're going to be under arrest. I'm going to search you incident to arrest. But would you be allowed to go with the consent first to see what they say and then go into a citation in lieu of an arrest without telling them that? And that would be lawful, which I think would be completely.
Yeah, as long as there's no condition that you know, if you say yes, I'll write you a ticket. If you say no, I'm going to arrest you. That obviously would coerce the consent. Yeah. So that,
right, for sure.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that, doing a consent route. And then we can just avoid this issue altogether. If they say yes, go ahead and search me, then we don't have to have this conversation, and you can search them and then cite them after the fact.
I think this leads into another good conversation of when we talk about consent, informed consent is very important. And I think you need to know how your consent procedures work in your state. So make sure you're checking the boxes that you need to check. But it should probably not sound like, hey, can I check you for anything? It should probably sound more like, Mr. Smith, you're detained lawfully right now. I'm asking you for consent to search of your person. That includes in your pockets, your shoes. You know, I'm going to be checking your legs. It's going to be a thorough search. I want you to understand that. It's not, well, we're not going to any private parts or revealing any parts of your body that are private to you. But it will be more intrusive than me just checking you for weapons. Do you understand what I'm asking for as far as consent goes? Do you agree to that consent? And if there's a refusal, it's okay. Well, now you're under arrest. And then you can reveal to them later on. Surely you can say, like, unfortunately, under arrest, that decision cannot be made. If you would have said yes to that, I wouldn't have to do this. And then I could have just, but, you know, that's the decision you made. Do you want to play? That's, I'm sorry, just the way it goes. And I can't, I have to follow the color of the law. I could not have told you that beforehand, that this would, because that would have been coercion.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with doing that. Any request for consent to search, I think, should include the word search somewhere in the request. Yeah, checking is not sufficient. Looking, I think if when we're asking for consent, somewhere in our request should be the word search. You know, can I search you and your belongings, you and your vehicle? There's no ambiguity to that kind of a request. I should say, because there's some states, Virginia is one of them, you know, there are some misdemeanor offenses where state law requires you to issue a citation. So the decision's been made for you. So there is no, let's hold off on making the citation decision. Let's go ahead and do the full search and then we'll, you know, proceed from there. That's not permitted in some states under state law. In Virginia, for example, for misdemeanors that occur in the officer's presence, the general rule is you have to issue them a citation. Unless you have some specific circumstances that may or may not be present. So this may not be an option in some states, because obviously you cannot violate state law. That would be grounds for obviously discipline and maybe some kind of civil liability as well. But there aren't a lot of states that have that.
And I think that here's another place where consent comes into play. You'd be surprised, especially when we're talking about somebody's person, you know, how cooperative people will be when asking for consent to search of the person. Because we know, one, you're probably not going to find 10 kilos of coke on their person. I always tell people, like, oh, I feel like someone was in the car. I'm like, nobody has a kilo of cocaine up their butthole. So what did you miss? Probably something small. And at the worst case scenario, I would think a gun that they weren't supposed to have. And that's, you know, that's significant enough. But the point is, don't beat yourself up. We have rules to play by, and you got to play by the rules. And right. People get very frustrated with the rules. Like, guys, I didn't make the fucking rules.
Yeah.
I'm just here to tell you what they are. I'm sorry that this disrupts the way you guys have been doing things historically. And the crazy shit was when we started talking about this, you know, search incident to citation and how it really didn't comply with the Fourth Amendment in some sense, which we've, you know, kind of taken a little bit of a different position, but not a big different position.
No.
You had people tell me, like, no, my agency says still do it. I brought this to their attention. They said still do it. And I'm like, you know, just get that in writing. Make sure that on a voicemail somewhere, because when it comes to court and you guys are being sued legally or civilly, I'm sorry, for an intrusion that violated the Fourth Amendment, just say, look, my boss told me I should be, and you'll be off the hook. We brought it to their attention and they told me keep doing it.
And they'll be more on the hook too. That's called deliberate indifference. That the agency would be more on the hook.
Oh, that's wild.
Yeah. I just want to make sure where I have evolved in my thinking was I was originally of the position you have to make the custodial arrest before you can do any search in a situation like this. Where I've backed off on that now is as long as you haven't written the citation or expressed an intent to write the citation, you can still do the full search incident to arrest.
And I would also think
that's where I've evolved.
I just, I can, and I hate to do this, and people do this to me, but I do have to side on the fact of like, what if they get a savvy attorney, which they don't. Like, let's face facts. The likelihood of you getting a savvy attorney is pretty slim to none.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we just had this conversation with an attorney that I'm friends with, and I'm like, how many people do you know that can actually go to trial as an attorney? He's like, almost none. So yeah. Most attorneys have never been on a trial, litigating a trial. They just haven't. You know, probably in the civil liability space for sure, but unlike criminal procedure, you don't have many people who can, who even know how to go to trial as attorneys. So you might have an attorney who, and that's why they're so valuable trial attorneys, that's why they're so respected, is because most people aren't good enough to go run a trial and like really try to defend or prosecute. A lot of people don't.
It's a skill. It's absolutely a skill. Yeah. In our, so, in our criminal justice system, most cases are pled out. Yeah. There is no trial.
Yeah. I think most cases in general, we do so not
civil
find
cases,
that.
Civil cases are settled before trial. Yeah. Very, very relatively few trials occur compared to how many cases are actually brought, criminal or civil.
All right. On to the next thing, if you're okay with that, to move forward.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Got a question for a guy yesterday, and this is a good question. So essentially, I know the answer, but I want to get your thoughts on it and let me know if the answer that I gave him was correct. I thought it's good for everybody to know. So essentially, a domestic violence incident occurs, and they go to find the person who committed the, they have probable cause to arrest the guy for the misdemeanor offense.
Okay.
And this offense is something that is, again, misdemeanor. There's no exigencies are being created off of this offense. The woman wasn't stabbed. He didn't shoot. There's not a gun. There's not children. There's no exigencies, just to be clear. So let's say they go four houses down and he's inside this house now. Now he answers the door. They ID him as the guy. They have PC to arrest. We know that that's good enough to arrest in a public place. The guy answers the door. Mm-hmm. So what they do is, because they have PC, probably a simple assault, maybe gave her a few bruises, beat her up a little bit. They grab him from the other side of the threshold and pull him out of the house and effect the arrest. So he said, yeah, I think I really screwed the pooch in this one. I said, I don't know if you screwed the pooch, because what we're talking about here may be very light in the civil litigation world of how much are you on the hook for a violation like this. And I could be wrong by saying that, but certainly we know that there was a violation because you didn't have a warrant, you didn't have exigencies, and he wasn't standing in the threshold of the doorway. He's on the other side of the threshold, two very different places to be.
Right.
So maybe you can elaborate a little bit about, now he didn't find anything incident to arrest. He didn't see anything in plain view. Okay. He didn't enter into the house. They grabbed him, pulled him from inside the house. We actually have a Jersey case like this, which is pretty funny. And I'll tell you this Jersey case before we go on. And it has to do with a police sergeant who intrudes into a house, violates the Peyton v. New York rule. I'm sorry. Peyton v. New York, right?
Santana is the, you're talking about the hot percent, the threshold.
Now we're actually still going to talk about the warrantless entry into a home, Peyton v. New York.
Peyton, yeah.
Okay. So we're in the same thing. So it's Peyton and then followed by Stiegel. Well, essentially what happens in this case in New Jersey was they violate Peyton and she shoves her body, the sergeant, in between the door and the door jamb, right? So she, like, you can imagine the guy goes to shut the door. She sticks her body in. Now he's shoving this police sergeant in the door. And so the courts, if I recall correctly, said she didn't have a right to enter into the house. But once he now essentially assaulted the police officer, what they're saying is you should have never tried to jam her in the door. You could have dealt with this in court later on your Fourth Amendment issues.
Yeah.
So she jammed herself. But once you assaulted that police officer, that gave him the right to create an exigency to now go into the house and arrest you. So what's crazy is the initial entry was no good. But once he assaulted the cop, now the entry was authorized. And when they went in and found stuff in plain view, that was not fruits of the poisonous tree. Isn't that interesting?
So the person that was to be arrested pushed the officer into the door? I mean, how?
Yes, they had a couple. I think what they did was they had a couple cops outside the door.
Okay.
He comes to the door. They obviously don't know case law, like 99% of cops.
Right.
They have PC to arrest this guy, but they don't have a warrant to go into his house. Oh, right. They don't have an arrest warrant. I'm sorry. Not even a warrant. They don't have a warrant to go to his house, or either or.
All right.
So when he goes to close the door on them and he tells them to get a warrant, she shoves her body in the door.
Here,
thereby committing an aggravated assault on a police officer.
When he slams the door on her.
When he slams the door. Like, and like he's like he it sounds like it's a pretty violent encounter. Like he's like shoving her in the door, like she's like stuck.
Right, right.
That's when things changed, and that continued entry was now authorized into the house for that action.
Okay.
And the plain view items that were subsequently seen were not fruits of the poisonous tree.
Okay.
Now I'm not. I just thought it was an interesting case to bring up, and I'll send it to you.
I'd like to look at that. Is that a new one?
No, it's been around for a long time.
Okay.
Yeah. It's probably on most people's sergeant's exams. You know what's crazy, dude? And I'll say this because I would say these things and people are just like, that can't be true. Well, one thing you could do in state New Jersey was arrest for the odor of marijuana on somebody's clothing. Now, this was well-established in case law here for many years. Obviously, marijuana is legal here. Now it's recreational. But the odor of marijuana allows you to arrest somebody and charge them with a CDS in presence misdemeanor CDS offense. You can actually arrest on this and testify to the odor of marijuana. Mm-hmm. As nuts as that sounds, when I started bringing that to people's attention, they were losing their minds. People never heard of such things. And there's a correlating story to this when my lieutenant said to me, you know, when you tell people these things, they think you're crazy. I go, yeah. He goes, because if I never heard this stuff or knew this stuff, because we have to read case law to get promoted where we are, I would think you're crazy too. So essentially what happens is after years of me explaining this piece of case law, that was actually a question on the New Jersey Civil Service Sergeant's exam.
Oh.
And those people who trusted old Den got that question right. And I understand that question was one of the most wrongly answered questions on the exam. Almost everybody got it wrong except those who took street cop training courses. And for some people, they believe it put them over the edge. One question can on a 100-question quiz or 150-question quiz.
Sure.
When you're that competitive, can make or break your ranking. And so a lot of guys reached out to me like, yo, bro, how sure are you about that? I'm like, I'm 100% positive. You're good. And so they get to once the thing's over and it's scored, you get to review it. Huh. And those people who listened to me were very, very thankful that they trusted me because they believed that it put them one or two places ahead of the other competition and got them promoted. So opinions didn't matter on a civil service exam.
Right.
What the law said was, and that's how it is. So back to this.
Yeah.
So let's go back to this domestic violence situation.
Yeah. All right. I got some notes here from that. All right.
Okay.
So he's all the way inside the house. The guy we want to arrest.
I don't say all the way. He answered the door.
But he's not in the threat. He's definitely not in that threshold area.
The threshold we consider is like standing on the threshold, right? Feet on the threshold, metal part of the door.
Right. That little 3 or 4 inch area.
I would even argue maybe it's even on some doors a foot. Right. Okay. You get a nice front door. You get a 1 foot threshold, I would argue.
But he's not in there. He's
behind it. He's not
behind
far.
It. Yeah, he's behind
five inches behind it.
All right. Well, that's an entry
behind it.
Yeah, that's an entry into the house. I mean, you have to draw the line somewhere. At some point, physically, that's where the entry begins. And yeah, if he's completely outside of the threshold on the inside of the house, then any entry is an entry. You know, whether I just have to reach my arm inside or put my foot inside, I'm now in his house, and absent exigent circumstances or a warrant or consent, it's illegal. So it sounds like there's no exigency. So it's just a regular assault and battery. The victim's not in the house. No reason to believe he's going to hurt somebody else. Right.
Right.
And there's we don't have a warrant, right? No arrest warrant for him. Then
Not yet. They can get one, but they haven't gotten it yet.
Right, right. So the entry is unlawful. But you said there was nothing. They found nothing inside the house and nothing on him. So there's no evidence to be excluded. So the criminal case is not affected by that. But you know, there's obviously civil liability is a possibility. But you know, in reality, I don't know that many plaintiffs' attorneys would take that case because the plaintiff's attorney has to get paid, and they get paid on basically depending on what the judgment is in the case. And I don't see a whole lot of
damages.
I don't see an award of damages that has a lot of zeros at the end of it, you know, so I don't know that it's a feasible case to take. And I'm not trying to diminish the Fourth Amendment violation nature. I'm of the opinion that there is no such thing as a small constitutional rights violation. I mean, all of them are serious, but not all of them are going to get awards of damages in the tens or hundreds or millions of dollars. So, yeah, it's a violation, but I don't know that there's a whole lot of likelihood that someone's going to actually have to pay for that in a civil case.
Hey guys, follow us on all social media platforms to include Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Facebook group. We have so much information going on every single day, and we don't want you to miss out on any of that stuff. So check it out. Go give us a follow.
Here's my frustration. I had a conversation with somebody recently. I think I brought it up on a couple podcasts ago. When somebody's being criticized for police work that they've done, and it was a violation of the Fourth Amendment, I try to give some leverage to the idea of, I think there's two very different ways to look at a situation when we're talking about police, quote unquote, misconduct. Were they explained the rules and then flagrantly violated them with malice? Or were they just never told and tried to do their job, but nobody ever explained to them what the rules are? And I think there should be two different lenses that we look at things like that. And I find it probably the most frustrating, if I had to say top three frustrating things for me in this profession, is that you expect a law enforcement officer to know how to do this job legally, yet have offered them no training, not even a direction of where to find the legal training to be able to operate legally in this profession. So, you know, and he said, well, I never thought of it that way. And I said, well, yeah, man, it's so easy to criticize, but let's put ourselves in his position. Did he get any other training that you then, you guys went to the same academy? Yeah, went to the same academy. Okay. What'd you learn then? I didn't learn anything. I learned until you guys came along. Cool. So he goes out, gets sent to a service call and does what he thinks is right, but it happens to violate the Fourth Amendment. Mm-hmm. Not a crazy one, but enough.
Yeah.
And now we want to criticize the guy, but he was actually just trying to do his job. Just nobody ever taught him how to do it. Right. And that's the frustrating thing for me, is whether these guys are getting fired and people just literally dust this stuff off to the side like it's not important, until it is important, until your fucking job's on the hook or your house is on the hook or your personal liability's on the hook because you didn't know what you were doing or you didn't want to spend the $200 to come to a case law class. I would argue that the amount of exposure that you reduce personally by attending each training course you go to is so significant that you couldn't put a value on it because you don't know the other side of the consequences could be for not taking that training.
Yeah, right. And unfortunately for that officer in that situation, you know, it is no defense to civil, let's do civil liability. It's no defense to civil liability that I wasn't trained. You know, right. I didn't know that was illegal is not a defense in a civil case. Now it may go towards the damages that you may have to pay. Like a jury may award less damages, but if you truly weren't taught, you can't do that. If that's true, and I'm not saying that that's not true, that happens all the time. That is a problem for your agency too, because it creates what's called potential deliberate indifference, which is the legal standard that a plaintiff has to meet when they sue an agency. So failing to train an officer on basic Fourth Amendment principles is a serious liability exposure for the agency. So the officer can also obviously be liable as well, whether he knew it or not. But it's the bigger issue to me, if I was a plaintiff's attorney, it would be his agency. I have a case of deliberate indifference on the part of them for failing to train the officer with basic Fourth Amendment knowledge. And of course, the exclusionary rule doesn't care either. The officer thought he was right, the evidence is going to be inadmissible. There is no general, and I posted about this the other day on the street page, the Facebook page. There is no general good faith defense. You know, just because you thought you were doing the right thing is not a defense for the exclusionary rule purposes or for civil liability.
You know, there's a lot of work to be done, but I think we can get a lot of stuff fixed and corrected in the time that we have. You know, what else are we going to talk about today?
That was all I had on my list, was my search incident.
Let's do one more real quick.
What you got?
Let's do again, because I keep getting this question over and over again, and maybe we have new listeners to the podcast. Let's do the search incident to arrest of items associated, like backpacks and bags.
Okay.
With the arrest day. Let's go back into this and talk about when and how and when not and why not.
So for search incident to arrest purposes, let's say we've arrested a guy that has a backpack. Chamel versus California is our basic our controlling case. We are allowed to search the person of the arrestee to make sure he doesn't have any weapons or evidence he could destroy. And then you also can search any area within his immediate control. And then Arizona versus Gantt clarified the Chamel rule. And that Gantt was a vehicle case, but the principle is the same in a backpack. Once you take the area out of the immediate control of the arrestee, so in this case, the area is the backpack, then it's no longer subject to search incident to arrest. So we place the guy under arrest, we handcuff him, we search him. That's a bright line automatic. Robinson says that's good to go. But then in the process, we've taken his backpack from him because we're not going to handcuff him while he's wearing a backpack. So we take it from him. We just kind of set it off to the side. We deal with him. We get him secured. We get him searched. We put him in the back of our police car. Now we're thinking about what to do with the backpack. Well, the backpack is no longer subject to search incident to arrest because he no longer has access to it. The underlying rationale for a search incident to arrest is to make sure the arrestee can't get access to weapons to attack us or affect an escape, or to make sure he doesn't destroy evidence. Well, he's now secured and locked in a police car. This backpack is nowhere near him. It is not subject to search incident to arrest. Gantt tells us that. And then the lower courts since Gantt have been applying that Gantt rationale to things like backpack. United States versus Davis out of the Fourth Circuit from 2021 is an example of a case that is a backpack case. So once you remove the item from the arrestee and you've secured him like with handcuffs guarded by a bunch of police officers, that backpack is no longer within the scope of search incident to arrest. Now there's doesn't mean you can't search it under other theories. There's if you have probable cause, you could search it under that, but you'd probably need a warrant because there probably aren't any more exigent circumstances. Cause again, no one can access the backpack. It's in our control. Inventory search is a possibility. If that backpack's going to be going with him to the detention facility, because the jail's going to search it if you bring it in there. So inventory is a possible possibility. Illinois versus Lafayette covers that type of a situation.
Okay. So what's the answer then? How do we remain or retain that ability to search incident to arrest of that backpack or pocketbook?
So pocketbook's obviously a little bit easier. You could just leave the pocketbook on the arrestee, you know, over his or her shoulder, you know, so while they're still handcuffed and that they're wearing the pocketbook, that's a much better argument for search incident to arrest because they still arguably have access to it because it's on their person. But once you move it from them, okay, and keep them away from it, that's a little bit harder to do with backpacks. I certainly wouldn't suggest leaving these things on the people just so you can search it. I think, now some arrests, that's just how they turn out. You know, we get the guy in handcuffs or the girl in handcuffs and they happen to still be wearing the backpack or the purse or whatever it is, then go ahead. Search incident to arrest is probably still viable there. But I think the normal procedure is to remove those items from the person, then handcuff them and search them. The trade-off is that's I think that's a safer way to arrest someone, but the trade-off is we probably have lost search incident to arrest authority on those items. Inventory, like I said, inventory search would be the most viable option in most cases, because I think in most arrest situations, that item is probably going with them to the jail. And it would be searched there inevitably when you get it to the jail. So Lafayette tells us that an inventory search would be appropriate because, you know, the jail wants to make sure you're not bringing contraband into their facility or weapons, and they're accounting for the arrestee's belongings. So when he or she's released, they get everything back. So inventory search, I think, is going to be your best alternative.
And for anybody who's listening from New Jersey, we do not have a bright line rule on inventory search. We actually have procedure in place. So just so you know, in New Jersey, and it's crazy, it sounds like, and they're like, New Jersey's progressive. What's wild is I have seen New Jersey come up with their cockamamie fucking plans and the U.S. Supreme Court follow suit right after, like years after, but they're like, yeah. And I'm like, well, we had this in Jersey already. So just so you're clear, if you're in New Jersey, as a police officer, we don't get an automatic bright line inventory search. And I just taught a big group and from an agency, and they're like, oh, looking at me. And I was like, you guys not do that? And they're like, no. And I'm like, yeah, you got to stop doing that. So here are the rules in New Jersey. And I'm going to continue to elaborate on this a little bit. The rules are, you must first ask for consent without probable cause or any kind of reasonable suspicion. Absent consent, if you have no other reason to try to, I don't get a sniff for this bag or PC to try to go apply for a warrant, you must offer or ask for a lawful disposition of the bag. What it means is, can anybody come pick this bag up? Mm-hmm. If there is nobody, if you got no consent, you get no agreeable consent, and there is nobody to pick the bag up to dispose of it, then you can inventory it, but you must check those two boxes first. So without doing that, you're going to be up Schitt's Creek, because and people, I've seen a lot of stuff get suppressed on this simple little thing, because people write in the reports, I went back, I inventoried the property, and we have about four or five cases that address that you cannot do this. It is a big no-no here.
So for Fourth Amendment purposes, obviously, I don't know if this is decided under New Jersey state law, but
Article 1, paragraph 7. Yep.
Yeah. So for Fourth Amendment purposes, let's say there's somebody on scene who's not getting arrested, who the arrestee says, hey, give my backpack to that guy. And that guy says, I'll take his backpack. Then for Fourth Amendment purposes, you have to give it to him. You can't do an inventory search of it. You can't take it just so you can search it. And so it sounds like New Jersey requires even more, that you have to ask him for an alternative disposition of the backpack. The Fourth Amendment says, the Fourth Amendment cases say that if there's an obvious alternative on scene right there, then you do have to explore that. We would have to give it to his friend who's there, who's willing to take the backpack. Like you said, absent probable cause to search it. If I have no reason to search it, I can't maintain custody of it just so I can do an inventory search. And as with all inventory searches, whether it's a vehicle or arrestee's belongings, there has to be a policy. You have to have some kind of directive from your agency that authorizes you to do inventory searches and gives you all the criteria and the procedures that go along with it. But the consent part, yeah, that's definitely not required under the Fourth Amendment, where you have to seek consent first and then proceed. So, yeah.
Just a reminder, that was for New Jersey folks only. Mm-hmm. We had something, we had a few cases here, State versus Bradley, State versus OYENUSI, Oyenusi. And essentially what New Jersey said, and obviously the U.S. Supreme Court changed that a little bit, was if you had a bag that was so contemporaneous with the arrest, so close in time and place that it considered to be one single part of one single transaction, a search incident to arrest of that bag was permissible. So essentially, Babadandu Oyenusi is being suspected for, I think they were doing medical fraud. So fake scripts, a lot of whatever stuff that would go along with medical fraud. So when they go to arrest him, he's carrying two plastic bags. And after they arrest him, they open the plastic bags after they put him in cuffs. And he came to court and said, you can't do that. And the court said, no. It happened right then and there. It was good to go. They merely opened the bag and they found all the stuff. Same thing. But Bradley also was another case where there was some kind of scam going on at a casino. So I think they had off-duty Atlantic City police officers working there. So they get Bradley. He's got this briefcase with him. They walk him, 15 minutes. They walk him through the casino to an area where security is, and this guy. Then they start searching his stuff, and they said, no, it's no good. Okay. You can't do that. So what's your thoughts on that, and how does that change? So, both of them are controlling in the state of New Jersey. Obviously, now we have this new Supreme Court. It wasn't actually a Supreme Court case. It was actually a
Circuit Court of Appeals. Yeah.
How does that change things for New Jersey when they talk about contemporaneous search? Do we have to abide by that? What do you think?
Well, no. So here's, obviously there's no Supreme Court case directly on point, but I can tell you the federal circuits are in agreement on this issue, that once the arrestee no longer has access to this area, he's secured, and this item, backpack, briefcase, purse, whatever it is, the federal courts are clear that it cannot be searched incident to arrest, even if, even if like 3 minutes ago we placed him under arrest, but
10 seconds ago
we placed him under arrest. Once he's secured, and secured generally means handcuffed, particularly behind your back, and he can't get into that item, it is not subject to search. But I can, and in New Jersey sounds like they're in the same boat as many other states. There is case law on the books in many other states. I can speak to Texas for sure, because I was just out there. They have a case called State versus Corvell that says, as long as the item was within his control when you arrested him, then it can be searched incident to arrest. And it sounds like New Jersey might kind of say the sort of the same thing. So at the time of arrest, so contemporaneous with the arrest, a little before, a little after, it was near him, it could still be searched. Now, obviously, that's still the law in Texas. That's still the law in New Jersey. But historically, where the federal courts go on a particular search and seizure issue, eventually the state courts are going to follow along, either because the Supreme Court weighs in and says you got to follow these rules, or because state courts start learning this is where the federal courts are going and they're revisiting some of their prior cases. So it takes a defense attorney to raise. So in New Jersey, let's say we have that situation here in New Jersey, and a defense attorney says, well, okay, we have this case law in New Jersey that says probably a good search, but hey, judge, the federal courts are saying something different on these issues. Could you maybe weigh in on that? Now, obviously, if it's a trial court, they have to follow the decision of the New Jersey court. It's not till it gets into the appellate system that maybe the court can revisit it. So I don't know if it's a court of appeals case or your Supreme Court, whoever's decided that, obviously that's the only body that can overrule the cases. But the state law in some states, New Jersey sounds like one of them, is in conflict with what the federal courts are saying. So eventually there has to be a resolution. Either the state courts will get on board with the federal courts or the Supreme Court of the United States will weigh in. And I think that's actually pretty likely to happen on some of these, since there's so many states that seem to not follow the same rule as the federal courts, that the Supreme Court's going to weigh in on this. And Gantt is the case that's driving all of these decisions.
Do you think that if one decision's made in one circuit of the federal system, that every other circuit will agree with them, or there's disagreements among the circuits? No,
there's frequently disagreement on amongst the circuits, which is one of the criteria the Supreme Court uses to decide whether to take cases. But on this particular issue, the circuits are unanimous. I think four, maybe five of the circuits, there's 12 circuits. There's 11 numbered circuits and then the DC circuit. At least four, maybe five of them have weighed in on this issue, and they so far have been unanimous. The other circuits just haven't address the issue. So it's not like the other, you know, six, seven or eight, whatever, are saying something else. They just haven't weighed in. But no, the circuits disagree with each other all the time on different legal issues.
So just because something happened in the Third Circuit doesn't mean everybody in the 11th Circuit needs to follow it.
No, right, exactly. Right. But now the more that do get on board with it, the less likely another circuit is to go rule differently, but it doesn't mean they can't. Yeah.
This is the last one, and this is essentially for some states that, and I think everybody can take a lesson from this one, but, you know, after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned and changed some of the rules in some of the more liberal states like New Jersey, New York, California, and now allows people to carry weapons, carry handguns. I don't want to say conceal carry because it's not the rules. We don't have a I don't know of anything yet that says in particular the state legislation requires a concealed carry, eventually open carry, from what I know thus far. And I'm going to preface that by saying I haven't done a ton of research on this, but I have yet to find anything when I did some research on what the fucking rules are regarding carrying a handgun in the state of New Jersey. So what happened is there are so many police officers here for so many years that know almost nobody can carry a gun here. So if you see somebody carrying a gun, it basically is almost a bright line rule that that gun's being carried illegally. However, now you're allowed to carry a gun. There are permits. There are permitted people who are carrying handguns in the state. So recently I was in a course and I was explaining to people, like, I'm walking down Main Street in your town. I've got a pancake holster on and a Colt 1911 strapped to my back. A woman calls and says, there's a man walking down Main Street with a Colt 1911 strapped to his back in plain view. And let's just, for shits and giggles, we'll not even call it that it was exposed. Maybe my shirt got stuck after I pooped. If you're a cop and you carry guns, like, sometimes that happens.
Right.
And so, like, your gun's sticking out. I mean, there's times where I've had a gun, people, like, I'm like, you know, sorry about that. Like, I don't want to cause alarm. I obviously look like a man who's probably a law-abiding citizen and more than likely a law enforcement official. But let's say this woman calls, you got a call for service, no menacing, no pointing the gun at anybody, no flagrant acts of violation of law, just merely carrying on walking down the street.
Okay.
And so I will pose this question to you. In a state now where people can carry guns, and there is no legislation on what a procedure is for how law enforcement is supposed to approach this situation, what can cops do? What should cops do?
I think your only your only option at this on those facts is a voluntary contact, a consensual
contact.
That's it.
Right.
That's it. You can't detain the person.
Nope.
You can see if you can ask them if they'd be willing to answer questions, and then we can talk about the gun or whatever you want to talk about, because it's a consensual encounter. But yeah, that's it. Even in Virginia, my entire career, you could carrying a firearm openly was lawful. You don't need a permit to do it. Obviously, there's certain people who can't carry firearms, but unless, and we would get calls all the time. Hey, there's a guy walking down the street with a openly carrying a handgun. Okay. We're going to dispatch an officer to that. But the officer needs to know what his legal authority is when he gets there. And in Virginia, and now every other state, unless you have some reason to believe this particular person is prohibited from carrying that firearm, he's a convicted felon, he's looks to be under the age of lawful carry, something like that. Unless you know something about this person, the only option you have, if you're going to engage the person, is a voluntary or consensual encounter, whatever term you want to use. And if he doesn't want to talk to you and answer questions, then you're going to have to let him be on his way, unless he's there's no evidence of a criminal violation under those facts that you just gave.
There's a prosecutor's office in New Jersey telling people, you grab the gun, you lock him up, and you charge him accordingly. And I'm like, we're doing it like we always did. You see a gun, you intervene. Oh, God. And I'm telling this group, and I'm glad that their agency hired me to come in and do training, because a lot of them are like, yeah, we're just going to, I'm like, no. And when you say somebody who looks to be under the age, guys, you can't play this game of like, he was 21, but he looked like he was 20. Like, you're talking about like a 12-year-old.
Yeah, right. No one can distinguish between a 21. You can't reasonably convince me you can tell the difference between a 21 and a 20-year-old just by looking at them. It's got to be objectively reasonable to think that person's under the age of 21 or 18, however old you have to be to carry a handgun in your state. That's going to take somebody who looks like they're 12 or 11, I would think, before you can, in most cases, make that argument. But yeah, I'm surprised that the prosecutor's office is telling your officers to do that, because that's
I'm not surprised. I'm just baffled. Yeah. I guess surprised and baffled. I'm just like I'm not surprised at all. It doesn't shock me one bit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you can carry a gun here. It's like, can you stop cause this actually, if you really think about it, goes back to the Jesus Christ. What's the Maryland case for the stopping cars, 1979?
Oh, Prowse, Delaware.
Yeah, Prowse. Yeah. Delaware. Delaware v. Prowse, 1979. Yeah. You can't just stop cars to check to see if they're licensed drivers.
Right. You can't just stop people to see if they're allowed to carry guns. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Now, how about this? You got a lawful investigative detention. You have a motor vehicle stop. You come to the car. You're a police officer in New Jersey. And the guy says, I'm a concealed carry. It's not concealed. I got to stop saying that. I think we just all go to CCW right away. But I'm a permitted carry guy. I have a handgun on my waist. You're lawfully seized. Can the police officer remove that handgun during the lawful detention?
So this one depends on what jurisdiction you're in, because the case law, there's definitely a split of authority. Now, I will caution that all of these cases are pre-Bruin. Bruin is the Second Amendment case you're referring to. The majority position nationwide is that as long as they're lawfully detained, which in this case they are, traffic stop, if you have at least reasonable suspicion, believe they're in possession of a firearm, then that is enough under Terry to take the gun, because being armed with a firearm is therefore dangerous, according to the majority position. Now, that doesn't mean you have to take the gun. It just means legally you would be covered. United States versus Robinson out of the Fourth Circuit, 2017, probably the leading case on that. But there are a significant number of cases that take the other position, that you need RS to believe they're armed and a reason to believe they may actually attack you, constitute a threat on this particular stop. I will say that even cases like Robinson are at least questionable now in light of Bruin. So now you kind of have the interaction with the Fourth Amendment issue, and there's also now a Second Amendment issue. Are we violating his Second Amendment rights when we don't have any reason to believe he's an actual threat to us by maintaining his possession of his firearm briefly during the stop? I'm inclined to think no, it's not a Second Amendment violation, but there are no cases on this issue yet. There will be. But I think for Fourth Amendment purposes, just purely Fourth Amendment purposes, would you be justified in taking his firearm? Yes, unless there is case law that clearly says you can't in your jurisdiction. And I don't know if there is any in New Jersey or not. I'd kind of be surprised if there was
case. There's really nothing yet.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, that's fine. I was going to say most states have not addressed the issue.
What if a state enacts legislation? So I've seen the show like Alaska State Troopers, when they stop a car and somebody's got a gun in the car, they'll tell them, one, you have to disclose to me within, as soon as I investigative side, that you have a weapon on, you can be cited for that or charged criminally. If you do not disclose that you have a weapon. And two, you'll see them take guns on traffic stops. And if they don't submit the guns, then they can be charged with that criminally as well. What's your thoughts on that?
Like they take the gun, like take it away with them.
Well, like a Terry frisk. They're lawfully stopped and they start to Terry frisk.
Mm-hmm. As far as
or a long frisk. Let's call it a long frisk, right? A Michigan v. long frisk.
Sure. Yeah. Which long is basically just Terry in a vehicle.
Of a car. Yeah. Right. But there's actually legislation in place
where you have to disclose.
Says, yeah.
Yeah. I don't think that kind of legislation would be unconstitutional. I mean, I think even in light of what Bruin tells us about the right to carry in public for self-defense, if you had a state law that said you have to if you're lawfully detained by a police officer, you've got to disclose to him you're carrying a firearm if you are. Otherwise, you can be arrested for that. I don't think that violates anyone's constitutional rights in that sense. So I don't know that a lot of states actually have such a law. We have in Virginia, you have to have a permit to carry concealed. And if you are carrying concealed and you're lawfully detained and the officer asks you if you're carrying, you have to disclose that. But you don't have to just announce it on a traffic stop. Like it sounds like in Alaska, maybe you do. Just from watching the show, maybe you would draw that conclusion. I don't know if states have such a statute, but I don't, even if they did, I don't. It doesn't strike me as something that would be unconstitutional.
I got one more for you, dude, and it's important. And okay. It's the new law that comes out of Indiana, and it's the obstructing law, where if a police officer gives a lawful command during the course of his duties, his or her duties, when they're carrying out some kind of lawful conduct as a police officer, to stay back, they have to keep a 25-foot barrier between the police officer and their lawful functions, and failure to abide by that essentially creates an obstruction of law or justice and justifies an arrest.
Does this have a filming component to it? Is this for people that are filming?
No. And one guy actually wrote, we did this video like, yeah, well, we want to be able to film you. Like, and I should have wrote back like, well, then just zoom in.
Yeah.
You know,
because Arizona has a statute and I know it's been challenged. I don't know where it is in the courts, but it says the same thing, but it deals with people filming. You can only film within X number of feet of an officer engaged in some enforcement conduct. I don't remember what the distance is.
This is your physical being cannot be within. If you're given the warning, cannot be within 25 feet of a police officer lawfully executing his duty. So it's not just a cop who's like hanging out off duty at the mall.
Yeah, right.
We're talking about it's a traffic stop. It's a detention, right? So as you're coming, you're basically creating a crime scene.
Yeah.
Hypothetical boundary. You know, I think I could argue with. Some of the things I'm gonna be on the horizon are like, what's 25 feet? How did you measure it? How did you know? Did they violate it?
Yeah, right. That's gonna be the first issue. Is how am I as the officer or the citizen supposed to know where this 25-foot line is?
I mean, if the crime scene tape is a lawful barrier,
yeah.
What's the difference between that and this?
Because that's a clearly defined barrier, though. This I don't. Yes, 25 feet is an identifiable distance, but how in the real world, how are you supposed to know where that line of demarcation is? And how do I prove beyond a reasonable doubt as the officer that you were in fact 25 feet away from me or within 25? I mean, I guess I could get the tape measure after I arrest you. I can go back and mark exactly where you were standing And is it 25 feet from me, the officer, or 25 feet from the scene, whatever that
the
is?
The officer. I think it says the officer. Okay. Now, I'm sure there'll be case law to clarify this. I think it's going to stick. I don't think there's a Fourth Amendment violation here. I think there's semantics that got to get figured out.
Yeah. I think it's going to be a hard one to prove. That's going to be a hard case for an officer to prove to win.
Well, I think a flagrant violation should be pretty easy. Guys getting up in your face, you got
sure,
it, right?
Sure.
Yeah, 25 feet. I mean, my suggestion to the cops in Indiana is like, let's not get crazy here with trying to come to 23 feet.
Right.
Like,
there you go. Right.
If I'm making hypothetical policy in Dennis Menino's brain, I sit as your sergeant and go, look, guys, I know it says 25 feet. Just for margin of error, let's call it 15.
Yeah, that's. Right? I was thinking the same thing. I was going to go with 10 or 12, but yeah, 15.
Let's call it 15.
Right.
And let's go out into the parking lot and measure what 15 feet looks like. And so in this zone, I'm saying you got it all day. Here's 25 feet. Out here, we don't have referees on the field and playbacks. Now, body-worn cameras will certainly help these cases, but my advice to those, and I think that you're going to see more agencies and more states adopting things like this. I really do. And crazy enough, I sent it to the media team today. I guess it was the new commissioner of the New York City Police Department basically did a press conference and said, we're done with your bullshit. Pursuits are up. And you ain't playing this shit in this city no more. Good. We're cracking down. So it was a 1 minute video. Uh-huh. And so my copy on that was that goes out. It was a copy of the writing that I put on the post is it's a big check to write. Let's see if they can cash it.
Yeah. It's one thing to do a news conference and say it. And then the next is to enforce it. But I get the spirit of it.
I'm with it, bro. I'm not saying you ain't going to do shit. Like, but you opened your mouth, homeboy. Let's see if you put your money where your mouth is. And do you have the backing of the mayor? And you know, I have seen, it looks like that New York City ain't playing games no more in the sense of like, they're not sitting around and letting shit happen and letting people throw shit at them and stuff. It seems like they're locking people up and they've got a lot more bravado now to do that. It seems like they have a lot more backing.
Right.
I guess they've just had enough.
Well, people are only going to put up with so much of it. Yeah. It's just the everyday law-abiding citizens are only going to put up with so much of this crap.
I think it's when you start to push onto like Fifth Avenue and Madison Avenue, where your people are, you know, values of buildings are down 20-30% when a building's worth $6 billion. You're talking it's lost $600-700 million in value. We've got a problem.
That's a lot of tax revenue going away,
bro. You know, you want to get shit. It's like New Jersey, right? So we didn't have the automobile exception for essentially 14 years. Mm-hmm. And so it was the theory that if we push these judges hard enough, which we did, we were killing the judges. We're just killing them. They couldn't go to lunch. They had to hear fucking written warrants nonstop all day long. State police policy was a nightmare. They had to get warrants for literally everything. They could almost never get consent. And I think we all believe that the lower court judges reached out to their friends and said, you need to fix this. And so the guy who is part of the case that changed it with State versus William Witt was contacted by the attorney general's office and said, we're going to run with this thing. Mm-hmm. And it was a dead duck, but it was the catalyst they need to flip it back to. They're waiting for a case that they could use.
Right.
So they found one. And even though they ruled negatively in his case, they said, yesterday, this case would have been bad. Today, moving forward, this would be a good search. And essentially, it was a search incident to It wasn't a search incident to arrest of a motor vehicle because we don't have them at all here.
Right.
It was probable cause to believe the evidence of a DWI offense had occurred. And that gave the police officer the ability to go in to the car and look for evidence of that offense. So, PC was established. Guy was arrested for drunk driving. And essentially, that's what. So he found a gun in the center console and they said, look, tomorrow, no problem. Good to go.
Yeah.
But yesterday, no good from this point forward. And it was a big document. They wrote like 40, maybe even 50 pages of an opinion of why it was such a failed thing.
Good.
Yeah. And I got to tell you, like, even though Pennsylvania went back to it because they're out of their goddamn minds. I mean, they elected that dude who can't even like stand up anymore.
It's embarrassing. Dude, yeah.
Bro, how's it embarrassing? Like, we have a president with Alzheimer's.
I know.
Think about that.
I know.
Right. And then you got this guy standing next to him who can't even talk. Anyway, so with that being said, that's all I have for you today.
Good stuff. Good day. Good talk.
Yeah, brother. Appreciate it, man. So again, if you want to take Zach's classes, check out streetcop.com. And, you know, everybody who takes his classes, when I run into them, I seem to, for some odd reason, follow up behind you and are like, hey, I took Zach Miller's class. It was fucking fantastic. So people, you're doing a really good job out there. You're the only instructor I haven't sat down and ever gone through your program with you. And basically Zach said to me, he's like, oh, this is the way I do it. And it's been working this way. And I'm like, well, if it's fucking working, I'm not going to adjust it. And everybody else pretty much shows up and says, this is what I got. And I go, yeah, it's no good. Zach clearly had time in the field and, you know,
they've been doing it for a while.
Why disturb it if it's working?
It's been working so far. So let's keep doing it.
Rock and roll.
All right.
Hey guys, check out our upcoming training at streetcop.com. Don't forget, we have 50 instructors nationally teaching a variety of topics. These are the best classes you're going to experience in your career. We make sure of it. You're going to love it. I guarantee you, you're going to be thankful that you went. Check us out at streetcop.com for all upcoming classes in your area.